until every heartbeat was about to blow his eardrums out for him. There was even a press conference at which the chimpanzee appeared. Enos, he was, of course. At the press conference, Bob Gilruth announced that John Glenn would be the pilot for the first manned orbital flight, with Scott Carpenter as the backup pilot. Dee Slayton would take the second flight, with Wally Schirra as the backup pilot. All the while, the astronaut who took the first flight was sitting right there at the table, quoth the brethren sotto voce. Number 85 stole the show, which was only just. He took the flashbulbs and all the talk and hubbub without blinking or even fidgeting, as if he had been waiting all along for his moment in the spotlight. Of course, the ape had been, as it were, overtrained for such a moment, and was long past being able to let such things alter his behavior. Number 85 had been in rooms full of bright lights and large numbers of human beings before. Noise, vibrations, oscillations, weightlessness, spaceflight, fame, what earthly difference did it make compared to the shocks and the box? At the outset, neither Glenn nor his wife Annie foresaw the sort of excitement that was going to build up over his flight. Glenn regarded Shepard as the winner of the competition, since he looked at it the way pilots had always looked at it on the great ziggurat of flying. Al had been picked for the first flight, and there was no getting around that. He had been the first American to go into space. It was as if he were the project pilot for Mercury. The best Glenn could hope for was to play Scott Crossfield to Shepard's Chuck Yeager. Yeager had broken the sound barrier and become the true brother of all the true brothers. But at least Crossfield had gone on to become the first man to fly Mach 2, and later on, the first man to fly the X-15. Not even when reporters began arriving in New Concord, Ohio, his old hometown, and pushing his parents' doorbell and roaming and foaming over the town like gangs of strays, looking for anything, scraps, morsels of information about John Glenn, not even then did Glenn fully realize just what was about to happen. The deal with Life kept all but Life reporters away from him, and so the other fellows were out trying to root up whatever they could. That seemed to be the explanation. The Cape hadn't turned into a madhouse yet. As late as December, Glenn could go out to the Strip on Route A1A in Cocoa Beach with Scott Carpenter, who was training with him as backup man, out to that little Contiki Village joint, whatever the name of it was, and listen to the combo play Beyond the Reef. John got a kick out of Beyond the Reef. By early January, however, it was madness to try to get to the Contiki joint or anywhere else in Cocoa Beach. There were now reporters all over the place, all of them rabid for a glimpse of John Glenn. They would even pile into the little Presbyterian church when John went there on Sunday and turned the service into a sort of muffled melee, with the photographers trying to keep quiet and muscle their way into position at the same time. They were really terrible. So John and Scott now stuck pretty much to the base, working out on the procedures trainer and the capsule itself. At night, in Hangar S, John would try to answer the fan mail, but it was like trying to beat back the ocean with a hammer. The amount of mail he was getting was incredible. Nevertheless, the training regimen created a curtain around John, and he didn't have as clear an idea of the storm of publicity and the passion of it all as his wife did. At their house in Arlington, Virginia, Annie was getting the whole storm, and she had practically no protection from it and few happy distractions. John's flight was first scheduled for December 20th, 1961, but bad weather over the Cape kept forcing postponements. He was finally set to go on January 27th. He was inserted into the capsule before dawn. Annie was in a state. She was petrified. This had little to do with fear for John's life, however. Annie could take that kind of pressure. She had been through the whole course of worrying over a pilot. John had flown in combat in the Pacific Theater in the Second World War and then in Korea. In Korea, he was hit 7 times by flak. Annie had also been through just about everything that Pax River had to inflict upon a pilot's wife, short of the visit of the friend of widows and orphans at her own door. But one thing she had never done. She had never had to step outside after one of John's flights and say a few words on television. She knew that would be coming up when John flew, and she was already dreading the moment. Some of the other wives were at her house for the danger wake, and she asked them to bring some tranquilizers. She wouldn't need them for the flight. She would take them before she had to step outside for the ordeal with the TV people. With her ferocious stutter, the thought of millions of people, or even hundreds, or even five, seeing her struggling on television, she had been in front of microphones with John before, and John always knew how to step in and save the day. She had certain phrases she had trouble with. Of course. Certainly. Not at all. Wonderful. I hope not. That's right. I don't think so. Fine. Thank you. And so on. And most of the questions from the television reporters were so simple-minded she could handle them with those eight phrases plus yes or no. And John or one of the children would chime in if any amplification was called for. They were a great team that way, but today she would have to solo. Annie could see the impending catastrophe easily enough. All she had to do was look at the television screen, any channel. It didn't matter. She could count on seeing some woman holding a microphone covered in black foam rubber and giving a declamation on the order of, "Inside this trim, modest suburban home is Annie Glenn, wife of astronaut John Glenn, sharing the anxiety and pride of the entire world at this tense moment, but in a very private and very crucial way that only she can understand. One thing has prepared Annie Glenn for this test of her own courage and will sustain her through this test, and that one thing is her faith. Her faith in the ability of her husband, her faith in the efficiency and dedication of the thousands of engineers and other personnel who provide his guidance system, and in her faith in Almighty God." In the picture on the screen, all you could see was the one TV woman with the microphone in her hand, standing all by herself in front of Annie's house. The curtains were pulled somewhat unaccountably, inasmuch as it was 9 o'clock in the morning, but it all looked very cozy. In point of fact, the lawn, or what was left of it, looked like Nut City. There were three or four mobile units from the television networks with cables running through the grass. It looked as if Arlington had been invaded by giant toasters. The television people, with all their gaffers and gophers and groupies and cameramen and couriers and technicians and electricians, were blazing with 200-watt eyeballs and ricocheting off each other, and the assembled rabble of reporters, radio stringers, tourists, lollygaggers, policemen, and freelance gawkers. They were all craning and writhing and rolling their eyes and gesturing and jabbering away with the excitement of the event. A public execution wouldn't have drawn a crazier mob. It was the kind of crowd that would have made the fool killer lower his club and shake his head and walk away, frustrated by the magnitude of the opportunity. Meanwhile, John is up on top of the rocket, the Atlas, a squat brute, twice the diameter of the Redstone. He's lying on his back in the human holster of the Mercury capsule. The count keeps dragging on. There's hold after hold because of the weather. The clouds are so heavy they will make it impossible to monitor the launch properly. Every day for 5 days, Glenn has psyched himself up for the big event, only to have a cancellation because of the weather. Now he has been up there for 4 hours, 4.5, 5 hours. He has been stuffed into the capsule, lying on his back for 5 hours, and the engineers decide to scrub the flight because of the heavy cloud cover. He's drained. He makes his way back to Hangar S, and they start taking the suit off and unwiring him. John is sitting there in the ready room with just the outer covering of the suit off. He still has on the mesh lining underneath and all the sensors attached to his sternum and his rib cage and his arms, and a delegation from NASA comes trooping in to confront him with the following message from on high.
"John, we hate to trouble you with this, but we're having a problem with your wife."
"My wife?"
"Yes. She won't cooperate, John. Perhaps you can give her a call. There's a phone hookup right here."
"A call?" Absolutely befuddled, John calls Annie. Annie is inside their house in Arlington with a few of the wives, a few friends, and Loudon Wainwright, the writer from Life, watching the countdown and finally the cancellation on television. Outside is the bedlam of the reporters, baying for scraps of information about the ordeal of Annie Glenn and resenting the fact that Life has exclusive access to the poignant drama. A few blocks away, on a quaint Arlington side street in a limousine, waits Lyndon Johnson, Vice President of the United States. Kennedy had appointed Johnson his special overseer for the space program. It was a sort of meaningless job that presidents give vice presidents, but it had a symbolic significance now that Kennedy was presenting manned spaceflight as the very vanguard of his new frontier, version number two. Johnson, like many men who have had the job of vice president before him, has been suffering from publicity deprivation. He decides he wants to go inside the Glenn household and console Annie Glenn over the ordeal, the excruciating pressure of the five-hour wait and the frustrating cancellation. To make his sympathy call all the more memorable, Johnson decides it would be nice if he brought in NBC TV, CBS TV, and ABC TV along with him in the form of a pool crew that will feed the touching scene to all three networks and out to the millions. The only rub to Johnson's way of thinking is that he wants the Life reporter, Wainwright, to get out of the house because his presence will antagonize the rest of the print reporters who can't get in, and they will not think kindly of the vice president. What he does not realize is that the only ordeal that Annie Glenn has been going through has been over the possibility that she was going to have to step outside at some point and spend 60 seconds or so stammering a few phrases. And now, various functionaries and Secret Service personnel are calling on the telephone and banging on the door to inform her that the vice president is already in Arlington in a White House limousine waiting to pull up and charge in and pour 10 minutes of hideous Texas soul all over her on national TV. Short of the rocket blowing up under John, this is the worst thing she can imagine occurring in the entire American space program. At first, Annie is trying to deal with it gracefully by saying that she can't possibly ask Life to leave, not only because of the contract, but because of their good personal relationship. Wainwright, being no fool, doesn't particularly care to get caught in the middle like this, and so he offers to bow out, to leave. But Annie is not about to give up her life shield at this point. Her mind is made up. She's getting angry. She tells Wainwright, "You're not leaving this house." Her anger does wonders for her stutter. It floods it right out temporarily. She's practically ordering him to stay. Annie's stutter often makes people underestimate her, and Johnson's people didn't realize that she was a Presbyterian pioneer wife living in full vitality in the 20th century. She could deal with any five of them with just a few amps from the wrath of God when she was angry. Finally, they're getting the picture. She's too much for them. So they start trying to bend arms at NASA to get someone to order her to play ball. But it has to be done very rapidly. Johnson is sitting out there a few blocks away in his limousine, fuming and swearing and making life hell for everyone within earshot, wondering, in so many words, why the fuck there isn't anybody on his staff who can deal with a housewife, for Christ's sake. And his staff is leaning on NASA, and NASA is bucking the problem up the chain until in a matter of minutes it's at the top, and the delegation is trooping into Hangar S to confront the astronaut himself. So there's John, with half his mesh underlining hanging off his body and biosensor wires sprouting from out of his thoracic cage. There's John, covered with sweat, drawn, deflated, beginning to feel very tired after waiting for 5 hours for 100 tons of liquid oxygen and RP-1 kerosene to explode under his back. And the hierarchy of NASA has one thing on its mind, keeping Lyndon Johnson happy. So John puts in the call to Annie, and he tells her, "Look, if you don't want the vice president or the TV networks or anybody else to come into the house, then that's it. As far as I'm concerned, they are not coming in, and I will back you up all the way, 100%, and you tell them that.
I don't want Johnson or any of the rest of them to put so much as one toe inside our house." That was all that Annie needed, and she simply became a wall. She wouldn't even discuss the matter any further, and there was no question any longer about Johnson getting in. Johnson, of course, was furious. You could hear him bellowing and yelling over half of Arlington, Virginia. He was talking about his aides, pansies, cows, gladiolas. Webb couldn't scarcely believe what was going on. The astronaut and his wife had shut the door in the vice president's face. Webb had a few words with Glenn. Glenn wouldn't back down an inch. He indicated that Webb was way out of line. Way out of line? What the hell was this? Webb couldn't figure out what was happening. How could the number one man himself, the administrator of NASA, be way out of line? Webb called in some of his top deputies and described the situation. He said he was considering changing the order of the flight assignments, i.e., putting another astronaut in Glenn's place. The flight required a man who could comprehend the broader interest of the program better. His deputies looked at him as if he were crazy. He'd never get away with it. The astronauts wouldn't stand for it. They had their differences, but on something like this, the seven would stand together like an army. Webb was beginning to see something he had never quite figured out before. The astronauts were not his men. They were in a category new to American life. They were single combat warriors. If anything, he was their man. One could imagine what would happen if Webb tried to exercise his authority nonetheless. Here comes the showdown. The seven Mercury astronauts on the TV explaining that in the very moments when their lives are on the line, he, Webb, is meddling, trying to curry favor with Lyndon Johnson, being vindictive because John Glenn's wife, Annie, would not let the hideous hand-wringing Texan into her living room to emote all over her on nationwide television. He sits in his office suite in Washington while their hides are up on the tip of the rocket. One could see the lines drawn in just that way. Webb would be issuing denials furiously. Kennedy would be the umpire, and it wasn't too hard to figure out which way the decision would go. The changing of the assignments was never mentioned again. Not long thereafter, an old friend visited Webb in his corner office, and Webb unburdened himself. "Look at this office," he said, making a grand gesture across a room with all the trappings of cabinet-level rank known to the General Services Administration syllabus. "And I cannot get a simple order carried out." But in the next moment, his mood changed. "All the same," he said, "I love those guys. They're putting their lives on the line for their country." Dryden and Gilruth decided to postpone the launch for at least 2 weeks, to the middle of February. Glenn made a statement to the press about the delays. He said that anybody who knew the first thing about the flight test business expected delays. They were all part of it. The main thing was not to involve people who became panicky when everything didn't go just right. Glenn went home to Arlington for a 3-day weekend. While he was there, President Kennedy invited him to the White House for a private get-together. He did not invite Webb or Johnson to join them. On February 20th, Glenn was once again squeezed inside the Mercury capsule on top of the Atlas rocket, lying on his back, whiling away the holes in the countdown by going over his checklist and looking at the scenery through the periscope. If he closed his eyes, it felt as if he were lying on his back on the deck of an old ship. The rocket kept creaking and twisting, shaking the capsule this way and that. The Atlas had 4.3 times as much fuel as the Redstone, including 80 tons of liquid oxygen. The liquid oxygen, the LOX, had a temperature of 293 degrees below zero, so that the shell and tubing of the rocket, which were thin, kept contracting and twisting and creaking. Glenn was at the equivalent of 9 stories up in the air. The enormous rocket seemed curiously fragile, the way it moved and creaked and whined.
The contractions created high-frequency vibrations, and the locks hissed in the pipe, and it all ran up through the capsule like a metallic wail. It was the same rocket locks wail they used to hear at dawn at Edwards when they fueled the D-558-2 many, many years before. Through the periscope, Glenn could see for miles down the Banana River and the Indian River. He could just barely make out the thousands of people along the beaches. Some of them had been camping out along there in trailers since January 23rd, when the flight was first scheduled. They had elected camp mayors. They were having a terrific time. A month in a Banana River trailer camp was not too long to wait to make sure you were here when an event of this magnitude occurred. There were thousands of them, off on the periphery as Glenn looked out. He could only see them through the periscope. They looked very small and far away and far below, and they were all wondering with a delicious shudder what it must be like to be in his place now. How frightened is he? Tell us. That's all we want to know. The fear and the gamble. Never mind the rest, lying on his back like this, with his legs jackknifed up above him, stuffed blind into the holster with the hatch closed, he couldn't help but be aware of his own heartbeat from time to time. Glenn could tell that his pulse was slow. Out loud, if the subject ever came up, everyone said that pulse rates didn't matter. It was a very subjective thing, many variables, and so on. It had only been within the past 5 years that biosensors had even been put on pilots. They resented them and didn't care to attach any importance to them. Nevertheless, without saying so, everyone knew that they provided a rough gauge of a man's emotional state. Without saying so, not a word, everyone knew that Gus Grissom's pulse rate had been somewhat panicky. It kept jumping over 100 during the countdown, and then spurted up to 150 during the liftoff and stayed that high throughout his weightless flight, then jumped again all the way to 171 just before the retro rockets went off. No one, certainly not out loud, no one was going to draw any conclusions from it, but it was not a sign of the right stuff. Add to that his performance in the water. In his statement about people who get panicky over the flight test business, Glenn had said you had to know how to control your emotions. Well, he was as good as his word. Did any yogi ever control his heartbeat and perspiration better? And, as the biomedical panels in the mission control room showed, his pulse never went over 80 and was holding around 70, no more than that of any normal, healthy, bored man having breakfast in the kitchen. Occasionally, he could feel his heart skip a beat or beat with an odd electrical sensation, and he knew that he was feeling the tension. And at the biomedical panels, the young doctors looked at each other in consternation and then shrugged. Nevertheless, he was aware that he was feeling no fear. He truly was not. He was more like an actor who was going out to perform in the same play, yet, once again, the only difference being that the audience this time is enormous and highly prestigious. He knew every sensation he would feel once the event began. The main thing was not to foul up. Please, dear God, don't let me foul up. In fact, there was little chance that he would forget so much as a word or a single move. Glenn had been the backup pilot, everyone said pilot now, for both Shepard and Grissom. During the charade before the first flight, he had gone through all of Shepard's simulations, and he had repeated most of Grissom's. And the simulations he had gone through as prime pilot for the first orbital flight had surpassed any simulations ever done before. They had even put him in the capsule on top of the rocket and moved the gantry away from the rocket, because Grissom had reported the odd sensation of perceiving the gantry as falling over as he witnessed the event through his periscope just before liftoff. Therefore, this feeling would be adapted out of Glenn. They put him in the capsule on top of the rocket and instructed him to watch the gantry move away through his periscope. Nothing must be novel about the experience. On top of that, he had Shepard's and Grissom's descriptions of variations from the simulations. On the centrifuge, you feel thus and such. Well, during the actual flight, it feels like that, but with this and that difference. No man had ever lived an event so completely ahead of time. He was socketed into the capsule, lying on his back, getting ready to do precisely what his enormous Presbyterian pilot self-esteem had been dying to do for 15 years, demonstrate to the world his righteous stuff. Exactly that, the Presbyterian pilot. Here he is, within 20 seconds of liftoff, and the only strange thing is how little adrenaline is pumping when the moment comes. He can hear the rumble of the Atlas engines building up down there below his back. All the same, it isn't terribly loud. The huge squat rocket shakes a bit and struggles to overcome its own weight. It all happens very slowly in the first few seconds, like an extremely heavy elevator rising. They've lit the candle, and there's no turning back, and yet there's no surge inside him. His pulse rises only to 110, no more than the minimum rate you should have if you have to deal with a sudden emergency. How strange that it should be this way. He has been more wound up for a takeoff in an F-102. "The clock is operating," he said. "We're underway." It was all very smooth, much smoother than the centrifuge, just as Shepard and Grissom said it would be. He had gone through the same G-forces so many times, he hardly noticed them as they built up. It would have bothered him much more if they had been less. Nothing novel, no excitement, please. It took 13 seconds for the huge rocket to reach transonic speed. The vibrations started. It was just as Shepard and Grissom said. It was much gentler than the centrifuge. He was still lying flat on his back, and the G-forces drove him deeper and deeper into the seat, but it all felt so familiar, he barely noticed it. He kept his eyes on the instrument panel the whole time, all quite normal, every little needle and switch in the right place, no malevolent instructor feeding abort problems into the loop. As the rocket entered the transonic zone, the vibration became intense. The vibrations all but obliterated the roar of the engines. He was entering the area of max Q, maximum aerodynamic pressure, in which the pressure of the shaft of the Atlas, forcing its way through the atmosphere at supersonic speed, would reach almost 1,000 pounds per square foot. Through the cockpit window, he could see the sky turning black. Almost 5 Gs were driving him back into his seat, and yet easier than the centrifuge. And all at once, he was through max Q, as if through a turbulent strait, and the trajectory was smooth, and he was supersonic, and the rumble of the rocket engines was more muffled than ever, and he could hear all the little fans and recorders in the busy little kitchen, the humming little shop. The pressure on his chest reached 6 Gs. The rocket pitched down. For the first time, he could see clouds and the horizon. In a moment, there it was. The Atlas rocket's 2 booster engines shut down and were jettisoned from the side of the shaft, and his body was slammed forward as if he were screeching to a halt, and the G-forces suddenly dropped to 1.25, almost as if he were on Earth and not accelerating at all. But the central sustainer engine and 2 smaller engines were still driving him up through the atmosphere. A flash of white smoke went up past the window. No! The escape tower was firing early, but the jettison tower light wasn't on. He didn't see the tower go. Wait a minute. There went the tower, on schedule. The jettison tower light came on green. The smoke must have been from the booster rockets as they left the shaft. The rocket pitched back up, going straight up. The sky was very black now. The G-forces began pushing him back into his seat again. 3 Gs, 4 Gs, 5 Gs. Soon, he would be 40 miles up, the last critical moment of powered flight as the capsule separated from the rocket and went into its orbital trajectory. Or didn't. Hey! All at once, the whole capsule was whipping up and down as if we were tied to the end of a diving board, a springboard. The G-forces built up, and the capsule whipped up and down. Yet no sooner had it begun than Glenn knew what it was. The weight of the rocket on the launch pad had been 260,000 pounds, most of it oxidizer and fuel, the liquid oxygen and the RP-1 fuel. This was being consumed at such a furious rate, about 1 ton per second, that the rocket was becoming merely a skeleton with a thin skin of metal stretched over it, a tube so long and light that it was flexing. The G-forces reached 6, and then he was weightless. Just like that. The sudden release made him feel as if he were tumbling head over heels, as if he had been catapulted off the end of that same springboard and was falling through the air doing forward rolls. But he had felt the same thing on the centrifuge when they ran the G-forces up to 7 and then suddenly cut the speed. At the same moment, right on schedule, a loud report. The Pasigrade rockets fired, throwing the capsule free of the rocket shaft. The capsule began its automatic turnabout, and all the proper green lights went on in front of him, and he knew he was through the gate, as they said. 0G, and I'm feeling fine, he said. Capsule is turning around. Glenn knew he was weightless. From the instrument readings and through sheer logic, he knew it, but he couldn't feel it, just as Shepard and Grissom had never felt it. The turnaround brought him up to a sitting position, vertical to the earth, and that was the way he felt. He was sitting in a chair, upright, in a very tiny, cramped, quiet little cubicle 125 miles above the earth. A little metal closet, silent except for the humming of its electrical system, the inverters, the gyros, the cameras, the radio. He had been specifically instructed to violate the fighter jock code of no chatter. He was supposed to radio back every sight, every sensation, and otherwise give the taxpayers the juicy stuff they wanted to hear. Glenn, more than any of the others, was fully capable of doing the job. Yet, it was an awkward thing. It seemed unnatural.
Oh, he said, that view is tremendous. Well, it was a start. In fact, the view was not particularly extraordinary. It was extraordinary that he was up here in orbit about the Earth. He could see the exhausted Atlas rocket following him. It was tumbling end over end from the force of the small rockets throwing the capsule free of it. He could hear Alan Shepard, who was serving as Capcom in the Mercury Control Center at the Cape. His voice came in very clearly. He was saying, "You have a go. At least 7 orbits." "Roger," said Glenn. "Understand. Go for at least 7 orbits. This is Friendship 7. Can see clear back, a big cloud pattern way back across toward the Cape. Beautiful sight." He was riding backward, looking back toward the Cape. It must be tremendous. It must be beautiful. What else could it be? And yet it didn't look terribly different from what he had seen at 50,000 feet in fighter planes. He had no greater sense of having left the bonds of Earth. The Earth was not just a ball beneath him. It still filled his field of consciousness. It slid by slowly underneath him, just the way it did when you were in an airplane at 40 or 50,000 feet. He had no sense of being a star voyager. He couldn't see any stars at all. He could see the Atlas booster tumbling behind him and beginning to grow smaller because it was in a slightly lower orbit. It just kept tumbling. There was nothing to stop it. Somehow, the sight of this colossal great tumbling cylinder, which had weighed more than the average freighter while it was on the ground and which now weighed nothing and had been discarded like a candy wrapper, somehow it was more extraordinary than the view of the Earth. It shouldn't have been, but it was. The Earth looked the way it had looked to Gus Grissom. Shepard had seen a low-grade black-and-white movie. Through his window, Glenn could see what Grissom saw. The brilliant blue band at the horizon, a somewhat wider band of deeper blues leading into the absolutely black dome of the sky. Most of the Earth was covered in clouds. The clouds looked very bright, set against the blackness of the sky. The capsule was heading east over Africa, but because he was riding backwards, he was looking west. He saw everything after he had passed over it. He could make out the Canary Islands, but they were partly obscured by clouds. He could see a long stretch of the African coast, huge dust storms over the African desert. But there was no sense of taking in the whole Earth at a glance. The Earth was 8,000 miles in diameter, and he was only 100 miles above it. He knew what it was going to look like in any case. He had seen it all in photographs taken from the satellites. It had all been flashed on the screens for him. Even the view had been simulated. Yes, that's the way they said it would look.
Awe seemed to be demanded, but how could he express awe honestly? He had lived it all before the event. How could he explain that to anybody? The view wasn't the main thing in any case. The main thing was the checklist. And just try explaining that. He had to report all his switch and dial readings. He had to put a special blood pressure rig on the arm of his pressure suit and pump it up. His blood pressure was absolutely normal, 120 over 80. Perfect stuff. He had to check the manual attitude control system, swing the capsule up and down, side to side, roll to the right, roll to the left, and there was nothing novel about it, not even in orbit, 100 miles above the Earth. How could you explain that? When he swung the capsule, it felt the same as it did in a 1G state on Earth. He still didn't feel weightlessness. He merely felt less cramped, because there was no longer any pressure points on his body. He was sitting straight up in a chair, drifting slowly and quietly around the Earth. Just the hum of his little shop, the background noises in his headset, and the occasional spurt of the hydrogen peroxide jets. "This is Friendship 7," he said, working just like clockwork on the control check, and it went through just about like the procedures trainer runs. Well, that was it. The procedures trainer and the alpha trainer and the centrifuge. He noticed that. In fact, he seemed to be moving a little faster than he had been on the alpha trainer. When you sat in the trainer, cranking your simulated hydrogen peroxide thrusters, they ran films on the screen of the Earth rolling by below you, just the way it would be in orbital flight. "They didn't roll it by fast enough," he said to himself. Not that it mattered particularly. The sensation of speed was no more than that of being in an airliner and watching a cloud bank slide by far below. The world demanded awe, because this was a voyage through the stars. But he couldn't feel it. The backdrop of the event, the stage, the environment, the true orbit, was not the vast reaches of the universe. It was the simulators. Who could possibly understand this? Weightless he was, in the vacuum of space, humming around the Earth, but his center of gravity was still back in that Baptist hardtack low-wrench stretch of sand in palmetto grass in Florida. Ah, but now this was truly something. 40 minutes into the flight, as he neared the Indian Ocean off the east coast of Africa, he began sailing into the night. Since he was traveling east, he was going away from the sun at a speed of 17,500 miles an hour. But because he was riding backward, he could see the sun out the window. It was sinking the way the moon sinks out of sight as seen on Earth. The edge of the sun began to touch the edge of the horizon. He couldn't tell what part of the Earth it was. There were clouds everywhere. They created a haze at the horizon. The brilliant light over the Earth began to dim. It was like turning down a rheostat. It took 5 or 6 minutes. Very slowly, the lights were dimming. Then he couldn't see the sun at all, but there was a tremendous band of orange light that stretched from one side of the horizon to the other, as if the sun were a molten liquid that had emptied into a tube along the horizon. Where there had been a bright blue band before, there was now the orange band, and above it a wider, dimmer band of oranges and reds shading off into the blackness of the sky. Then all the reds and oranges disappeared, and he was on the night side of the Earth. The bright blue band reappeared at the horizon. Above it, stretching up above about 8 degrees, was what looked like a band of haze created by the Earth's atmosphere. And above that, for the first time, he could make out the stars. Down below, the clouds picked up a faint light from the moon, which was coming up behind him. Now he was over Australia. He could hear Gordon Cooper's voice. Cooper was serving as the CAPCOM at the tracking station in the town of Moshé, out in the kangaroo boondocks of Western Australia. He could hear Cooper's Oklahoma drawl. "That sure was a short day," said Glenn. "Say again, Friendship 7," said Cooper. "That was about the shortest day I've ever run into," said Glenn. Somehow, that was the sort of thing to say to old Oklahoma Gordo sitting down there in the middle of nowhere.
Kind of passes rapidly, huh? Said Gordo.
Yes, sir, said Glenn.
The clouds began to break up over Australia. He could make out nothing in the darkness except for electric lights. Off to one side, he could make out the lights of an entire city, just as you could at 40,000 feet in an airplane. But the concentration of lights was terrific. It was an absolute mass of electric lights, and south of it there was another one, a smaller one. The big mass was the city of Perth, and the smaller one was a town called Rockingham. It was midnight in Perth and Rockingham, but practically every living soul in both places had stayed up to turn on every light they had for the Americans sailing over in the satellite.
The lights show up very well, said Glenn, and thank everybody for turning them on, will you?
We sure will, John, said Gordo.
And he went sailing on past Australia with the lights of Perth and Rockingham sliding into the distance. He was over the middle of the Pacific, about halfway between Australia and Mexico, when the sun began to come up behind him. This was just 35 minutes after the sun went down. Since he was traveling backward, he couldn't see the sunrise through the window. He had to use the periscope. First, he could see the blue band at the horizon becoming brighter and brighter. Then the sun itself began to slide up over the edge. It was a brilliant red, not terribly different from what he had seen at sunrise on Earth, except that it was rising faster and its outlines were sharper.
It's blinding through the scope on clear, said Glenn. I'm going to the dark filter to watch it come on up.
And then needles, a tremendous layer of them, Air Force communications experiment that went amok. Thousands of tiny needles gleaming in the sun outside the capsule. But they couldn't be needles because they were luminescent. They were like snowflakes.
This is Friendship 7, he said. I'll try to describe what I'm in here. I am in a big mass of some very small particles that are brilliantly lit up like they're luminescent. I never saw anything like it. They're round a little. They're coming by the capsule, and they look like little stars. A whole shower of them coming by. They swirl around the capsule and go in front of the window, and they're all brilliantly lighted. They probably average maybe 7 or 8 feet apart, but I can see them all down below me also.
Roger, Friendship 7. This was the Capcom on Catton Island out in the Pacific. Can you hear any impact with the capsule? Over.
Negative, negative. They're very slow. They're not going away from me more than maybe 3 or 4 miles per hour.
They swirled around his capsule like tiny weightless diamonds, little bijou. No, they were more like fireflies. They had that lazy but erratic motion, and when he focused on one, it would seem to be lit up, but the light would go out, and he would lose track of it, and then it would light up again. That was like fireflies, too. There used to be thousands of fireflies in the summer when he was growing up. These things were like fireflies, but they obviously could be any sort of organism, unless all the astronomers and all the satellite recording mechanisms had been fundamentally wrong. They were undoubtedly particles of some sort, particles that caught the sunlight at a certain angle. They were beautiful, but were they coming from the capsule? That could mean trouble. They must be coming from the capsule, because they traveled along with him in the same trajectory at the same speed. But wait a minute. Some of them were far off, far below. There might be an entire field of them, a minute cosmos, something never seen before. And yet the Capcom on Canton Island didn't seem particularly interested. And then he sailed out of range of Canton and would have to be picked up by the Capcom at Guaymas on the west coast of Mexico. And when the Guaymas Capcom picked him up, he didn't seem to know what he was talking about.
This is Friendship 7, said Glenn. Just as the sun came up, there were some brilliantly lighted particles that looked luminous that were swirling around the capsule. I don't have any in sight right now. I did have a couple just a moment ago when I made the transmission over to you. Over.
Roger, Friendship 7.
And that was it.
Roger, Friendship 7. Silence. they didn't particularly care. Glenn kept talking about his fireflies. He was fascinated. It was the first true unknown anyone had encountered out here in the cosmos. At the same time, he was faintly apprehensive. Roger, Friendship 7. The Capcom finally asked a polite question or two about the size of the particles and so on. They obviously were not carried away by this celestial discovery. All of a sudden, the capsule swung out to the right in a yaw, out about 20 degrees. Then it was as if it hit a little wall. It bounced back. Then it swung out again in the yaw and hit a little wall and bounced back. Something had gone out in the automatic attitude control. Never mind the celestial fireflies, he was sailing over California, heading for Florida. Now all the Capcoms were coming alive. All right. President Kennedy was supposed to come on the radio as Glenn came over the United States. He was going to bless a single combat warrior as he came over the continental USA. He was going to tell him the hearts of all his fellow citizens were with him. But that all went by the boards in view of the problem with the automatic controls. Glenn went sailing over Florida, over the Cape, starting his second orbit. He couldn't see much of anything down below because of the clouds. He no longer cared particularly. The attitude control was the main thing. One of the small thrusters seemed to have gone out so that the capsule would drift to the right, like a car slowly skidding on ice. Then a big thruster would correct the motion and bounce it back. That was only the start. Pretty soon, other thrusters began acting up when he was on automatic. Then the gyros started going. The dials that showed the angle of the capsule with respect to the Earth and the horizon were giving obviously wrong readings. He had to line it up visually with the horizon. Fly-by-wire. Manual control. It was no emergency, however. At least not yet. As long as he was in orbit, the attitude of the capsule didn't particularly matter, so far as his safety was concerned. He could be going forward or backward, or could have his head pointed straight at the Earth, or could be drifting around in circles or pitching head over heels, for that matter, and it wouldn't change his altitude or trajectory in the slightest. The only critical point was the re-entry. If the capsule was not lined up at the correct angle, with the blunt end and the heat shield down, it might burn up. To line it up correctly, fuel was required, the hydrogen peroxide, no matter whether it was lined up automatically or by the astronaut. If too much fuel was used keeping the capsule stable while it sailed around in orbit, there might not be enough left to line it up before the re-entry. That had been the problem in the Apes flight. The automatic attitude control had started malfunctioning and was using up so much fuel they brought him down after two orbits. Every 5 minutes, he had to shift his radio communications to a new Capcom. You couldn't receive and send at the same time, either. It wasn't like a telephone hookup. So you spent half the time just making sure you could hear each other. Friendship 7, Friendship 7, this is CYI. That was the Canary Islands Capcom. The time is now 16:32:26. We are reading you loud and clear. We are reading you loud and clear. CYI. Glenn said, this is Friendship 7 on UHF. As I went over recovery area that time, I could see a wake, what appeared to be a long wake in the water. I imagine that's the ships in our recovery area. Friendship 7, we do not read you. Over. Friendship 7, this is Kano. At GMT 16:33:00, we do not... This is Kano. Out. Friendship 7, Friendship 7. This is CYI Comtech. Over. Glenn said, hello, Canary, Friendship 7. Receive you loud and a little garbled. Do you receive me? Over. Friendship 7, Friendship 7. This is CYI Comtech. Over. Hello, Canary, Friendship 7. I read you loud and clear. How me? Over. Friendship 7, Friendship 7. This is CYI, Comtech, over. Hello, CYI, Comtech, Friendship 7. How do you read me? Over. Friendship 7, Friendship 7. This is CYI, CYI, Comtech. Do you read? Over. Roger, this is Friendship 7. CYI, I read you loud and clear. Over. Friendship 7, Friendship 7. This is CYI, Comtech. Do you read? Over.
Hello, CYI, Comtech. Roger, read you loud and clear. Over.
Friendship 7, this is CYI, Comtech. Read you loud and clear. Also, on UHF. Stand by.
Roger, Friendship 7.
Friendship 7, Friendship 7, Friendship 7. This is Canary Copcom. How do you read? Over.
Hello, Canary Copcom. Friendship 7, I read you loud and clear. How me?
Finally, the Canary Islands Copcom says, I read you loud and clear. I am instructed to ask you to correlate the actions of the particles surrounding your spacecraft with the actions of your control jets. Do you read? Over.
This is Friendship 7. I did not read you clear. I read you loud but very garbled. Over.
Roger. Cap asks you to correlate the actions of the particles surrounding the vehicle with the reaction of one of your control jets. Do you understand? Over.
This is Friendship 7. I do not think they were from my control jets. Negative. Over.
There, exactly 5 minutes to get one question out and one answer. Well, at least they finally showed an interest in the Fireflies. They wondered if they might have something to do with the malfunctioning thrusters. Oh, but it was a struggle. In any case, he was not particularly worried. He could control the attitude manually if he had to. The fuel seemed to be holding out. Everything hummed and whined and buzzed as usual inside the capsule. The same high background tones came over the radio. He could hear the oxygen coursing through his pressure suit and his helmet. There was no sensation of motion speed at all, unless he looked down at the Earth. Even then, it slid by very slowly. When the thrusters spurted hydrogen peroxide, he could feel the capsule swing this way and that, but it was like the Alpha Trainer on Earth. He still didn't feel weightless. He was still sitting straight up in his chair. On the other hand, the camera, when he wanted to reload it, he just parked it in the empty space in front of his eyes. It just floated there in front of him. Way down there were little flashes all over the place. It was lightning in the clouds over the Atlantic. Somehow it was more fascinating than the sunset. Sometimes the lightning was inside the clouds and looked like flashlights going on and off underneath a blanket. Sometimes it was on top of the clouds and it looked like firecrackers going off. It was extraordinary, and yet there was nothing new about the sight. An Air Force Colonel, David Simons, had gone up in a balloon alone to 102,000 feet for 32 hours and had seen the same thing. Glenn was now over Africa, riding over the dark side of the Earth, sailing backward toward Australia. The Indian Ocean Capcom said, "We have message from MCC for you to keep your landing bag switch in off position. Landing bag switch in off position. Over."
Roger, said Glenn. This is Friendship 7.
He wanted to ask why, but that was against the code, except in an emergency situation. That fell under the heading of nervous chatter. Over Australia, old Gordo Cooper, got on the same subject.
Will you confirm the landing bag switch is in the off position? Over.
That is affirmative, said Glenn. Landing bag switch is in the center off position.
You haven't had any banging noises or anything of this type at higher rates?
Negative.
They wanted this answer.
They still didn't say why, and Glenn entered into no nervous chatter. He now had two red lights on the panel. One was the warning light for the automatic fuel supply. All the little amok action of the yaw thrusters had used it up. Well, it was up to the pilot now to aim the capsule correctly for re-entry. The other was a warning about excess cabin water. It had built up as a byproduct of the oxygen system. Nevertheless, he pressed on with the checklist. He was supposed to exercise by pulling on the bungee cord and then take his blood pressure. The Presbyterian pilot. He did it without a peep. He was pulling on the bungee and watching the red lights when he began sailing backward into the sunrise again. 2 hours and 43 minutes into the flight, his second sunrise over the Pacific, seen from behind through a periscope. But he hardly watched it. He was looking for the Fireflies to light up again. The great rheostat came up, the Earth lit up, and now there were thousands of them swirling about the capsule. Some of them seem to be miles away, a huge field of them, a galaxy, a micro-universe. No question about it, they weren't coming from the capsule. They were part of the cosmos. He took out the camera again. He had to photograph them while the light was just right.
Friendship 7, the Canton Island Capcom was coming in. This is Canton. We also have no indication that your landing bag might be deployed. Over.
Glenn's first reaction was that this must have something to do with the Fireflies. He's telling them about the Fireflies, and they come in with something about the landing bag. But who said anything about the landing bag being deployed?
Roger, he said, did someone report landing bag could be down? Over.
Negative, said the Capcom. We had a request to monitor this and to ask you if you heard any flapping when you had high capsule rates.
Well, said Glenn, I think they probably thought these particles I saw might have come from that, but there are thousands of these things. And they go out for, it looks like, miles in each direction from me, and they move by here very slowly. I saw them at the same spot on the first orbit. Over.
And so we thought that explained all the business about the landing bag. They gave him the go-ahead for his third and final orbit, and he sailed over the United States. He couldn't see a thing for the clouds. He pitched the capsule down 60 degrees so he could look straight down. All he could see was the cloud deck. It was just like flying at high altitudes in an airplane. He was really no longer in the mood for sightseeing. He was starting to think about the sequence of events that would lead to the retro-firing over the Atlantic after he had been around the world one more time. He had to fight both the thrusters and the gyros now. He kept releasing and resetting the gyros to see if the automatic attitude control would start functioning again. It was all out of whack. He would have to position the capsule by using the horizon as a reference. He was sailing backward over America. The clouds began to break. He began to see the Mississippi Delta. It was like looking at the world from the tail gun perch of the bombers they used in the Second World War. Then Florida started to slide by. Suddenly, he realized he could see the whole state. It was laid out just like it is on a map. He had been around the world twice in 3 hours and 11 minutes, and this was the first sense he had of how high up he was. He was about 550,000 feet up. He could make out the Cape. By the time he could see the Cape, he was already over Bermuda.
"This is Friendship 7," he said. "I have the Cape in sight down there. It looks real fine from up here."
"Raj, Raj," that was Gus Grissom on Bermuda.
"As you know," said Glenn.
"Yeah, verily, sonny," said Grissom.
Oh, it all sounded very fraternal. Glenn was modestly acknowledging that his loyal comrade Grissom was one of the only three Americans ever to see such a sight, and Grissom was calling him sonny. 20 minutes later, he was sailing backward over Africa again, and the sun was going down again for the third time, and the rheostat was dimming, and he saw blood. It was all over the windows. He knew it couldn't be blood, and yet it was blood. He had never noticed it before. At this particular angle of the setting rheostat sun, he could see it. Blood and dirt, a real mess. The dirt must have come from the firing of the escape tower, and the blood, bugs, perhaps. The capsule must have smashed into bugs as it rose from the launch pad, or birds. But he would have heard the thump. It must have been bugs, but bugs didn't have blood. Or the blood red of the sun going down in front of him, diffusing, and then he refused to think about it anymore. He just turned the subject off. Another sunset, another orange band streaking across the rim of the horizon. More yellow bands, blue bands, blackness, thunderstorms, lightning making little sparkles under the blanket. It hardly mattered anymore. The whole thing of lining up the capsule for retrofire kept building up in his mind. In slightly less than an hour, the retro rockets would go off. The capsule kept slipping its angles, swinging this way and that way, drifting. The gyros didn't seem to mean a thing anymore. And he went sailing backward through the night over the Pacific. When he reached the Canton tracking point, he swung the capsule around again so that he could see his last sunrise while riding forward out the window with his own eyes. The first two he had watched through the periscope because he was going backward. The fireflies were all over the place as the sun came up. It was like watching the sunrise from inside a storm of the things. He began expounding upon them about